This program is brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you hear, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guest is Nico de Oliveira and Jamie George. These are today's guests, I should say. You run the gallery with Nikki Oxley. So it's Nico de Oliveira and Nikki Oxley are co-curators and co-founders of the SE8 Gallery in Deptford, which started as the Museum of Installation.
That was many years ago, and we've just got a new website up, and we've started thinking about the idea of websites not just as places to put some information about current work, but to try and treat it perhaps as a sort of archive, to think about the depths that might be found in a library rather than on a website. And indeed, as you say, the question of the Museum of Installation does crop up here and there, as do some of the other spaces, even further back in time, such as Unit 7 Gallery, where we did our first exhibitions in Camberwell, in fact, as well as other spaces like Notice Gallery and, of course, external projects that we're very much involved with. So the idea is that it's a sort of portal that can lead to all sorts of, sometimes, of course, blind alleys, because they may not be quite ready yet, but at other times, real kind of jewels that are otherwise lost somewhat in time.
I noticed the website describes you as a not-for-profit independent gallery.
Yes.
How does the gallery support itself?
In the past, we used to receive grants, apply for grants, spend a lot of time doing this, particularly at the point when you're doing one show after another and you have commitments that run all the way through the year with exhibitions opening and closing, both in the specific gallery spaces that we operate in, but also external spaces. And we found that over time, because we were doing many more projects in other cities, abroad, in other institutions, curating them, as well as writing a lot of books, this took over, and we realized that it wasn't possible to do everything. So to carry on going as a bona fide gallery space that was doing one show after another ceased to be what we ended up doing. At present, the projects work much more like residencies, which is to say that, for example, Olivia Gieg, before Jamie George, for instance, spent a year and a half in the space because it coincided with lockdown and the pandemic. So essentially, it became a kind of studio for her. But prior to that, we worked with other artists such as David Allen. He made his show over 4 or 5 months. And somehow, even though we never quite intended it that way, things kind of slipped into the mode of residencies. And this idea of a residency really functions well with us because it means that you have time. And time, I think, is a real commodity in the art world.
And what are the criteria for the artists that you choose? I mean, how did you arrive at Jamie George, for example?
We used to have very specific criteria, and when people used to ask us a long time ago, what's an installation, which used to be our mainstay, we were always a little evasive because we didn't want to cut off avenues that we might otherwise not explore. I think definitions and conditions may change, and they're really only temporary. Now, we're at a point where things happen often by happenstance, almost in a serendipitous manner. So, for example, Jamie came to the book launch where Olivia Gieg and I were discussing her book, essentially 12 months ago. And one thing led to another because it was connected to an artist called Andrew Bick, with whom we've been in dialogue for years, and other folk. And before you knew it, suddenly out of this coalesced a discussion and an exhibition. And often these things are actually based on relationships. It's a real bonus to be able to do what you want to do and to let the course of the exhibition process run. That gives freedom to the artist, but it also means that you're not constrained by a massive program. Mm. Although, of course, I dare say at the moment, a lot of the program is taking us outside the space. So things change.
So the your current show is Jamie George, which runs from the 28th of October to the 3rd of December. And this show is called Lack. A series of wall-based cast plasterworks originating from the iconic design of an IKEA float shelf, which also titles the exhibition. Is that the name of the shelf, Lack? Or?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And this absolutely incredible piece of graphic design, which I suppose must have been around for like 20, 30 years. A single piece of paper with a computer drawing of a shelf on it and this word Lack in the IKEA font. It's like one of the most beautiful bits of design I've ever seen.
Really? So it's just the shelf?
Yeah. So you buy a floating shelf. It comes in three different sizes.
Right.
Yeah.
And how does it differ from any shelf?
I feel like I'm going to be... I'm kind of promoting an IKEA shelf.
Well, but perhaps you are.
I think one of the kind of key components is of the exhibition, which is made up of three bodies of work. One of these bodies of work is a series of these shelves, which I've cast in pigmented plaster and flipped them on their side, so they become unfunctional.
Right.
And for me, there's a kind of reference to a kind of baffle or an architectural motif. They look almost like they're made of concrete with these.
Yeah. It's quite a thick shelf, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's much thicker than an ordinary.
5 centimetres, 50 millimetres.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it looks, the images I've seen of it make it look almost like a monolith, that right?
Yeah.
I mean, puts me in mind slightly of 2001, perhaps.
Yeah, and we were talking about an artist called John McCracken.
Oh, yeah.
The other day,
right.
Minimalist art. So it's kind of flipping some of those ideas on their head.
But your casts, I think, include defects.
Absolutely, yes.
So, I mean, for instance, the monolith in 2001 is an immaculate piece of... whatever the thing is, but in your case you're incorporating, I think you use the word vandalism.
Yep.
Would the shelf have been vandalised?
So, no, it's the actual plaster cast itself. So one of the things that I've been really interested in is in architectural casting, shuttering is used to make a concrete pour, and that the kind of quality of that finish that we see on buildings all around London,
right,
all around the world, the quality of that finish is sort of a signifier of the kind of quality of the building, and that each cast, when the shuttering is taken away, can have these beautiful sections where the pour has kind of mottled and things like that. They can also be really patchy and kind of a bit dodgy in places. And, and for me, I'm kind of interested in some of those, what I considered to be gestures within making, being kind of retained or kind of
Are they accidental selected gestures? They're not
some of which, and then a series of the works in the body have been attacked at a kind of wet state.
Right, attacked by whom?
By me. And so, again, okay. I think this kind of
so
this,
is there an auto-destruct element?
Yeah.
Right.
I think there's an interesting thing within the titling, which each one has got either a tick or a cross next to it, and this comes from some of these gestures and actions that are made within producing the work. This idea of like a correct vandalized action or an incorrect one, and I suppose I'm fascinated by the kind of scale of a gesture. For example, We've all seen it around, say, the base of a piece of outdoor furniture, right. And a bit of concrete's been poured, and someone has written J4S.
Okay.
Yeah. And that might have been this kind of throwaway, momentary thought that's cast in concrete for decades, perhaps. And for me, I'm really interested in kind of picking up some of those gestures with these different temporalities in them.
Okay, so just to be clear, you started with the shelf.
Yep.
You then make a mould.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you then cast it in plaster.
Yep.
And it's then painted, or
no? Each one has a different amount of pigment in it.
Ah,
so
the pigment's in the plaster,
exactly.
But that makes it black. Yeah,
yeah. Right. Yeah. Or they actually are quite
dark,
kind of chalky. Yeah, chalky.
Okay.
Color.
Right.
Yeah.
There's another reference there, which we've talked about quite a lot, which is the famous Kura sculptures. Perhaps you'd like to say something about that and this relation to the body and vandalism.
Yeah, it's sort of part of a tandem body of work. But I've been thinking a lot about the Greek Kuros sculptures, and specifically the time that they were vandalized, mostly by Christian monks, and this kind of switch between. I would say classical Greek period of art and a Roman Christian, or like kind of paleo-Christian, and a lot of these Kairos sculptures were vandalized, particularly around the face. Sometimes they would have crosses carved into their foreheads or onto limbs, and again it when you see these statues, they're incredible that they not only have the makings of the originator, the person that originally carved, or mostly carved, but sometimes bronze poured the originals, but this hand of this other person and this gesture that kind of lives throughout the ages. And yeah, I'm really fascinated by ideas of vandalism within this way.
Hmm. Does that tap into graffiti at all?
Oh. I think...
I was thinking actually of photographs by Brassai of graffiti, where he recorded walls, mostly in Paris, I think, where people had gouged into stone and made these sort of face-like shapes all sorts of marks like that. When I saw the image of yours, it's one with a scratch like that. It made me sort of think of that somewhat. But maybe graffiti isn't on your radar.
No, I think it's a good reference. I think it's as much to do with the time and the temporality of the gesture and the way that something very throwaway, maybe almost unthinking, can become have this extremely long lifespan and alter an object. What we often think of in a negative way, but can be an incredibly beautiful gesture or act.
Right.
Yeah.
But that also takes us quite nicely to your interest in detritus, garbage, and eventually processes of entropy in the magazine series, for example.
Yeah, so another body of work that's in the show are a series of relief works that I made.
Right.
Magazine coming...
But they hang on the wall, don't they?
They do, yeah.
And they look like, from a distance, you would think maybe they were paintings or pictures. So it's a rectangular shape.
Yeah.
But it's made of, one of them here is described as resin and shredded documents, including physiotherapy back pain documents. And a letter from my mother about ill health, unused letter paper, and photographs of me in the bath. And these documents, shall we call them, have all been shredded?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
So all you get is like a strip of illegible, you wouldn't know what it was.
Yeah.
And then that's all compiled.
Yeah.
How is that fixed to the whatever, is it glued down or just loose in a Perspex sort of container, or how is it sort of held together?
So the way that they're produced is, or rather, the way that they originated was an interest in making a sheet material. So like a lot of sheet materials, that is a composite of a material that then is bound by glue.
Right.
So at the time of beginning the project with SE8 Gallery, I had started kind of playing around with this, I would say, a kind of like broken archive of my past. Old tax returns, letters, all that stuff that I wanted to get rid of but didn't really want to throw away. That stuff that was kind of...
Had you been hoarding it for a long time? Had you got boxes and boxes of this stuff?
Boxes and boxes.
Oh, right.
Yeah, boxes and boxes.
Right. And so you stored it. You had it. Was that a conscious decision to store it with a view to making art out of it, or you just hang on to the stuff anyway?
Yeah, I think it was just the stuff that one might find in an attic, or that you realise that you... These kind of this sort of detritus that follows you around in life, and that as I started kind of clearing this, I started realizing that there were these kind of narratives by bringing some of these shredded materials together, and then not only a narrative, but also a kind of particular hue. So each one of these works and that are made up of these composited materials has a very particular color to it that can only be made up out of these bits of rubbish, shredded rubbish.
Right. Lots of them sound very personal.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, photographs of me in the bath and a letter from my mother about ill health is a sort of memoir aspect or diaristic sort of element to these, or it's just your own history?
I think for me as a body of work, it sort of comes... It's the closest that I come to kind of writing within making. And writing is a kind of a parallel activity to making sculpture for me. And for these works, I was really interested in how materials... We have this kind of idea that maybe a material has a kind of honesty to it. Yet within this work, there was a kind of... It enabled me to play around with some of that. And there are other materials in there, and that I've chosen to kind of highlight some of these, let's call them ingredients, for the viewer to be able to start to kind of bring together a narrative or a potential narrative within each work.
Well, there's a really nice connection. The obvious connection is obviously Burroughs, cut up, and so on and so forth, but Jean-François Lyotard, the philosopher, makes an even more interesting analogy where he says that texts kind of can function like a crumpled piece of paper which has text on it, and it suddenly, by the act of crumpling, brings text in contact with other texts that have never been in contact before. Mm. So this idea of an act that's actually deeply performative.
Mm. Right. I saw an exhibition in Edinburgh a few years ago of Dieter Rote, where he'd apparently he collected absolutely every scrap of paper, everything he'd owed, tickets and receipts, everything, sweet wrappings. And I think he kind of documented them or archived them, and they were all on display in this exhibition in Edinburgh. Are there any influences on your work, or is anyone who's...
Yeah, he's an amazing artist, particularly his book works.
Right.
I also like the chocolate pieces as well. He made a series of sculptures out of chocolate that would turn white over time.
Right, right.
Again, this idea of sculpture in relationship to a kind of temporality or...
So you do writing as art. Is it they're not artist books as such, or do they become artist books, or is it's the written piece is the artwork?
I think I feel like in a way writing occupies or reaches the spaces that I think making objects sometimes can't, and so for me that they are reflexive acts. So often after making a body of work that's made of objects, or sometimes I make prints as well. Writing might be the kind of antidote to some of those things.
Okay.
But I think one of the things that I'm very interested in writing is how you can define the space that things happen in and be able to bring things together in that might be from one's past or from a country that you have never been to, like in a very economic way, bring these things together and hold them together just for a moment in a way.
So how does the writing manifest itself in you as your art practice? I mean, does it become a wall piece or a print or
no,
how does it?
It sometimes finds its way in different forms, but predominantly I'm interested in the red text. So things get published. I sometimes put things out as physical texts. But I suppose I'm also very interested in, I think a lot of my work, I'm interested in the notion of intimacy of the work.
Mm.
And
it's a very interesting connection, I think, with sculpture quite literally, in the sense that text has a kind of horizontality, the way that text is set up on the printing press, the way we read, you know, from left to right or from right to left, depending on where we are. And it has a series of intervals. And one of the things that that Jamie's talked about a lot is the way that words are smithed by themselves, but equally that they have a function of how they appear on the page. So, for example, the publication that we're making with Jamie is actually designed by Jamie. It's not so usual that for us, the artists, design our publications, because for every exhibition we make a pocket-sized publication. But in this case, we thought it absolutely correct that Jamie ought to have that as an extension space. In a sense, it's a kind of installation in book format, but it looks very much like a book.
Right. So there will be a finished book from this text,
that's right,
which will be launched
December, on the 3rd of December.
On the 3rd of December?
Yes.
At the gallery, SE8 Gallery. Right. Yeah. Okay. And so, I mean, in a way, it's like a sort of personal archaeology, isn't it? This sort of maybe this would be a good opportunity for you to read.
Yeah,
read
of course.
A text. Is this an existing text, or is this text composed for Resonance, or is this a pre-existing artwork?
This is so. I've got a couple of things that I've brought with me, all of which will be in the book that we're publishing on the 3rd.
And does that come under the heading Lack as well? Is this all part of the, or is this another?
It's going to have a separate title as a book, but for me, that it very much is part of a project that has been going on for, I would say, for me, a body of research that's lasted probably about 2 years, and then been focused through the conversation with Nikki and Nico over the last almost 12 months, I would say.
Okay.
Predominantly over the last couple of months, but yeah, I've got a couple of things. The first one I thought would be quite interesting here. It's essentially a kind of list of words, and it's called Untitled. Hoardings, pliable, stiff, stiffies reveal, picking, picked, scabbing, scratching, separating, spread, spreading, caked, clotted, cleaned. Chain link, taut, arch, arc, pig pen, goalpost, fenced. Bale, straw, stuck, stick, brick, floppy, pitch. Pelmet, plummet, screened, scaffold, wounded, in pieces. Scrubland, Minecraft, catalogue, volume, aperture, tight fit. Lean to, waiting, weighted, separated again. Canopy, curtain, container, cupped, almost contained. Floor, joist, box, boxed room, box cart, box cutter. Lay, lane, lie down, hack. Bleachers, banisters, ballast. Post, prop, pumped, dumped. Dropped, crowd, coward, lost, leaving, left. Everything in its right place, formed around a false work. And that's a piece that I wrote earlier this year, specifically after a research trip that I'd taken to Pompeii and Naples, where I was kind of thinking a lot about the making of the world around us. And for me, the exhibition, the project rather, was a series of texts that were in a way written to explore a relationship to placemaking, and that the exhibition echoes that in responding to a series of materials, mostly plaster and this other material that we were talking about in the magazine series, but also the site of the gallery and the space of the gallery itself. And this idea of placemaking is quite important within that. And that's what
I'm
a lot
sure,
of the takes
not around. Quite sure what you mean about placemaking. What is that? How do you define that?
I think, again, it goes back to these sort of ideas around gesture, that a place can be made by simply placing an object.
Oh, okay.
A camp can be the throwing down of a jacket in a park for... to have a sandwich,
right.
But it can also be a place that is militarized and an enormous. Mm. And I'm interested in the scale and temporality of how place is produced. And for me, making the exhibition, one of the things that I talked to Nikki and Nico a lot about is this idea of responding to the site, responding to the gallery, and thinking about how to place the works within the gallery that can try and generate the idea of a new site or a new place.
An artist that we worked with quite extensively, David E. Price, who now lives in Stockholm, and I think he's actually been on one of the Resonance programs some years ago.
Yeah. I think he came onto my show on Wavelength. He came on twice,
yes,
I think.
That's right. And he's also a novelist. And he's taken the analogy of Kierkegaard and applied this to the gallery space. And he argues that a gallery space, particularly a project space, when it's related to a work like a large sculpture, an installation, something related to the site, the gallery becomes like a sort of field, in a field that's resown time and time again. And in order for it to be functional, it also has to lay fallow for a while so it can actually reinvigorate itself. And somehow for us, this seemed a really apt metaphor for the kinds of projects that we've been doing in more recent years, where the gallery is a kind of entity that needs a certain degree of care. You have to paint it, you have to clean it. Mm. But equally, artists come in and then they make a place out of this. And why is it that they never run out of material? And I would say it's firstly, of course, because each artist makes a very different and new proposition, but also because I don't think they're actually mining the gallery in the strictest sense. They're actually giving space to the gallery, and somehow the work that comes out of it is a kind of letting the place be whilst making certain decisions about shifting the space around in some way.
Mm. Might be worth reading another text at this stage.
Sure.
Again, maybe to kind of like bring together this idea of like placemaking and how it can happen very slightly. Mm. And that it's those kind of that slightness that I'm kind of interested in. So this is a piece that I wrote last year, which was published in a book by Outpost Gallery in Norwich. It's called Offin. You often used the word during our phone calls after you moved. I'd ask what you were working on and you'd tell me about what was in the offing. There was always something of a promise in the word. The most wonderful way it deftly denotes both place and time. The time, the not too distant future, and the location, a section of deep sea visible from the shore. It used to be written offin, the spelling of which I wanted to use exclusively here, but the spell check on my laptop keeps auto-correcting it. I can't bear the little brown, the little red broken line under the letters where the word processor shows something is amiss. I always end up immediately changing it, correcting the mistake like a game of whack-a-mole. In our telephone conversations around that time, you also like to use the phrase beyond the pale, another expression suggesting the transgressing of limit of perceived limits. You also regularly dropped in the word apropos, which I never really understood, but it didn't seem to matter, as I always got the gist of what you meant. Every time you said in the offing, it seemed exotic, especially as I pictured you speaking to me on the phone, a silver cordless handset, as you sat in your taupe armchair in the living room of a sensible little flat encircled by privet hedges far from the ocean. I thought about the word because I read it in the opening phrases of The Hearts of Darkness just last week. I'd begun reading the story when I stayed at your friend's house for a few days. I went through the bookshelves and pulled out the Conrad collection almost at random and read a few pages, but that was all. But when I saw the word there on the first page of Conrad's story, I remember how you first explained its meaning to me when I was small. You started by using your hands as props, like abstract markers, balling my hand and making a flat plane of yours, working it out as we went along. Like when a sports team makes a hand pile or that mashed potatoes game. I didn't understand, so at that point you decided to change tack. You surveyed the kitchen for props, and finally, the tablecloth got scrunched back. The Heinz salad cream became the ship, its label immediately seeming somewhat nautical. We became the salt and pepper, the chess pieces next to a gnarly glazed ceramic bowl. The bowl that was out of place on the table and that a friend had given us a few years before. That bowl suggested a dwelling, a hut, a home that we, the salt and pepper, lived in. There we stood on the crumpled linen shore, looking out to sea. The yellow formica kitchen table top, a mill pond. At the edge of the table, the end of the world, you landed your index finger on its surface, where the formica inlay met the wooden edging and said, here's the offing.
So that sounds like it's addressed to one person.
Yeah.
Who might that be?
That's very, very similar to these characters that are in the material list of the resin works,
right.
this other person being quite elusive. And for me, my interest within that is also thinking about sculpture and, who's the viewer. In a way, the object in the room addresses the gallery, but addresses the viewer. Mm. And I'm kind of interested in perhaps this other person knocking around.
At one point in the text, I assumed you were talking to your mother.
It's not completely explicit within the text.
Oh, I see. It can be left open then. It's a bit, I think it's where you said being small or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Which made me think you must have been a child at the time or of that memory.
Yeah, I suppose also there's a notion of, I think a lot of art writing, let's call it, is often quite... the notion of writing being to a kind of like academic audience is something that doesn't interest me. And this idea of intimacy, almost writing something that might sound or feel like a letter,
right?
for a single person, this again goes back to this idea of how you might install something in an art gallery, that you're trying to speak directly to the person looking at it, that there's an intimacy there, which is often, I think, absent in a lot of art.
Mm-hmm. It also sort of begs the question of what the purpose of the gallery actually is. And we talk about it, you know, endlessly as, you know, white cubes, or then you change the color and then it's stripped back as it was, you know, years ago in some of the other spaces that we've occupied. But ultimately, it doesn't really matter what it is. There's always a place to be made, regardless of what that particular place is. And of course, part of what we do is that we have a degree of formality through which we set a gallery space up. And that's something that's very particular to the visual arts, because in the visual arts, we have the tradition where artists name artworks. And this starts with Duchamp in particular. But equally, I think it now means that curators nominate spaces and nominate galleries. Mm. So all of these are constructs. They are all, in that sense, as you just rightfully said, in the offing.
It brings me to, I sort of did a bit of, what's hardly call it research, but I sort of scouted around. I came across something you did called The House That Jack Built.
Yeah, which is another text I wrote, or was commissioned to write by Goldsmith CCO.
Okay.
It was a response to an exhibition that was curated by one of their curators called Natasha Hoare,
right,
for an exhibition called Transparent Things.
I was intrigued by it. I printed it out with a view to sort of, I thought I'd bring it along, and for some reason, the printer, as you can see, it only printed it because it's done in this sort of side by side format, and my printer would only print like half of that. I don't know if that's a fault of the printer, but I only got a section of the left hand.
Yeah, you're missing
piece.
A bit.
I'm missing a bit. But
I can't read this view if you're missing.
No, I don't know if that's a sort of. But would this have been on a printed page looking like that, where you've got paragraphs on the right and paragraphs on the left, or are these opposite pages in a book, or is it a sort of
It was format. Arbitrary? Knowing that it was published online on their website,
and okay.
I designed the PDF quite specifically, thinking about each paragraph or section to revealing something more, or kind of staging the one after it.
Right.
The way that it's formatted on the page is really, really particular.
Right. And there was a bit that struck me in particular, which I now can't find. Where on earth is it? It's on page. Yes, here we go. Because I have a bit of a thing about synchronicity. Because I did a book myself called Perfect Binding, which is a sort of memoir, and it's an introduction written by Dan Wilson, which is about synchronicity. But the bit that leapt out at me from your piece was this paragraph where it says, "Jack was the name of my best friend when I was a child. Jack died. We were in our late teens. He stepped off a train platform late one night. He had been drinking. No one knows if it was an accident or if he meant to step off the platform. I wasn't there. We had grown apart that year." And curiously, in my memoir, I mention a friend who died at the age of 28, and he also he was a photographer, and there was a sort of a suggestion that he'd fallen from a speeding train, but in fact there was his fall from a speeding train was rumored to be death by misadventure, but it was witnessed by a traumatized fellow passenger and reported in the Leicester Mercury as a dive into the void ? So what's the story with Jack and your friend Jack? How does he? Is there anything to be expanded on there, or is it too personal to kind of? It's probably leapt out. It's completely out of context, of course. But there's a whole lot more to it than that. But
the text is about transparency, And I suppose for me, in writing and in making in sculpture, but predominantly in writing, I'm really interested in when a text or a piece of information can be seen as hard and fast or transparent, and so or versions of that. And so I think maybe if we think about a relatively contemporary term of autofiction, where there's kind of questions around whether something is true or false, or where does fiction happen? I suppose for me, I'm less interested in that and more interested in maybe how a text or a piece of text can create something that is more like an object, and that that object there that you just read out, very similar to the object that you read out from your piece of writing, how that impacts on these other objects that happen. So as Nico said, I think about writing quite sort of spatially in a way. The information is kind of spatial.
And but it's very, it's, what's the word? It's I mean, to be that piece is not sculptural. I mean, it seems very personal and what's the word? Dramatic even.
But I think what I mean is that how that piece of dramatic information or that dramatic object, being the kind of paragraph, perhaps, the section, how that impacts on the things around it. So that ends up being...
So it's the context of it, then?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
All right. But it also, I presume it relates to a person you did actually know. This isn't a fiction.
It's completely fictional. Yeah.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh. Oh, I've fallen for it then. So you didn't have a friend called Jack?
Maybe we could at this point do something kind of slightly naughty and play a particular track. And I'm thinking here of the Japanese track that kind of displaces and doubles. And it is, of course, about love.
I can kind of segue slightly. So I suppose I'm interested in affect. I think we have a lot of us have lost people at certain stages in their life, and that's loss is a really it's inherent in the exhibition title, lack.
Right.
And I'm interested in sort of the affect of loss, and that to say that there wasn't a person called Jack. But I have known Jacks.
Yeah.
And therefore, these pieces of information become very, very, very formal. And I'm interested in how they bump up against the other things within the text. To move on from that, something that Nico and I have been talking about recently is, this idea of... how objects and things transmit kind of information, and sometimes that information kind of is retained and falls away. I've got a little quote from something that I think it sets up this piece of music quite well.
Okay.
And this is written by Neil Cummings from a book called Reading Things, which was, written in 1993. And this was the introduction to the book.
Was that with Marisha Lewandowska, by any chance?
I'm not sure. I've read it in the Whitechapel's document.
Okay.
So I'm just going to read this. Take this quote out of it. How exactly are objects patterned with meaning and value? How, for instance, do they begin to trap historical transient experiences like love beads, Ben Sherman shirts and safety pins? We could update that now, I think. Mobile phones, water bottles, etc. Most of our material world, like the iceberg, lies beneath the threshold of our comprehension, and things flow past and rest silently a sediment shaping our consciousness. If our experience of time is dovetailed into the representation of the present, the object, like the pop song, can snare the fleeting moment as it falls away from memory. And I'm interested in that idea of, again, notions of affect that might be within a pop song, that then when they get translated, say, through multiple playing or through a cover version, mm-hmm. which of those things of the affect are retained and which fall away? So Nick and I were talking the other day about great songs that have been heavily covered. Mm. A really good example of this is The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face, mm-hmm. Originally written by Ewan McColl and Peggy Seeger, or two or four Peggy right. Seeger, but known by The River Flack. Mm-hmm. There's also an amazing Andy Williams version of it, which is fantastic. Mm. Leona Lewis made, I was looking them up today, endless things. And another version of that is Love Will Tear Us Apart by Joy Division. There's some amazing late 80s versions of Love Will Tear Us Apart.
So who the version we're going to hear, who is this by?
It's by a Japanese musician who was kind of a bedroom artist. This piece was put out just a few years ago by the Cafe Otto label. Oh. And it's kind of a re-release. I think it was written in 1983. But the thing that I'm most interested in within this is the way that the translation is kind of dropped, and that in the singing of it, in the kind of chorus element, the words fall away, but maybe there's something about the kind of original sentiment from Ian Curtis's melody that is retained. So again, it kind of relates to a lot of the text that I'm writing about, how bits of information are retained through an artwork and other bits can fall away. But anyway, we can have a listen to it.
Nico, you have you brought a music track along as well?
Yes, and in a sense this segues quite nicely from the track that we just heard. And what it is, it's a remake of Neil Young's title track, guitar solo, from Dead Man, the Jim Jarmusch film, which he famously scored while watching rushes of the film live. And it's an epic guitar solo which countless people online have actually imitated, men and women sitting in their bedrooms, a little bit like the track that you've just mentioned, Jamie. But in this case, it's changed rather, because the artist actually performs it, and he performs it one time only, but he performs it for 6 hours and 1 minute in order to beat Ragnar Kjartansson's famous collaboration with The National, where The National at MoMA, I believe, played the famous song Sorrow for 6 hours. So this goes 1 minute beyond that. And of course, it's very much an exercise in entropy, because what begins to happen is that the playing slowly starts to fall apart and begins to come together again. So it's this sort of powerful entropic moment where the artist tries to control the space. The space is full of people. People come and go. It's a black painted space, very good acoustics, black carpet on the floor. It's very much a durational piece. And so he's playing away at this, having taught himself to play in the style of Neil Young, actually even aping certain mannerisms, etc. And he talks about the idea of doing something for so long and with an audience, meaning that he transports the art audience to a kind of concert. And afterwards, in his diary, he writes that he felt like he'd done something heroic, because he'd withstood this particular time and he had not faltered. And he says, somehow, I felt like a minor god. And this is Eric Pavin playing Dead Man. At SE8, he contacted us to write a very short text, and we liked the project so much, which he was training for, but it hadn't happened yet. So we flew to Portugal, watched the 6 hours, and produced the book out of that. So the idea of being able to work quite fast, chronicling something, but also adding something else to it, which then led to another object, in a sense.
Okay, so you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today's guests were Nico de Oliveira and Jamie George, whose exhibition Lack is on at the SE8 Gallery from, remind me the dates.
Can you? From right now until the 3rd of December.
Right. And what's the address? I mean, how does people find it? I mean, is it Deptford High Street?
It's 171 Deptford High Street, and you can either go to New Cross or you can go to Deptford Rail Station.
Okay.
And the wonderful new website.
Yes, the new website, which is se8.gallery, nice and short.
Yeah.
And we're going to finish off with a piece of music, which is what, 30 minutes long, I think. Obviously, we're going to just trim it down to about 5 minutes.
5 minutes.
What is this piece?
I suppose so this piece of music is a drone piece of music performed by Roderick Davey, who works often with a singer-songwriter called Richard Dawson, but he's an experimental improv harpist. Mm. And this piece was written by Eleanor Radagou, who is a predominantly electronic musician. And I selected it because I'm kind of fascinated by things happening in spaces. And the exhibition at SE8 was really fascinating process for me to make, thinking about what we were talking about before, about this idea of like how to make something in a space, and that could only be seen there. Mm-hmm. And that this piece of music, I've actually never seen it being performed live, but it has to be the way that it happens in a space is mm-hmm. Is absolutely key to it being in the world. But it can play a
what's it extract. Called? Do we have it?
It's called Occam One.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance FM. If you like what you heard, please support our work by making a donation at resonancefm.com/donate.